नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय यस्य कार्यचिद् राजन् पुमान् वेदविदित्सितम् यद्विजिगशयाव्युक्ता मुयन्ति कवयोपिः
O King, no one can know the plan of Lord Sri Krishna. Even though great philosophers inquire exhaustively, they are bewildered. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The bewilderment of Maharaj Yudhisthira over his past sinful acts and the resultant sufferings, etc., is completely negated by the great authority Bhishma, one of the 12 authorized persons. Bhishma wanted to impress upon Maharaj Yudhisthira that since time immemorial, no one, including such demigods as Shiva and Brahma, could ascertain the real plan of the Lord. So what can we understand about it? It is useless also to inquire about it. Even the exhaustive philosophical inquiries of sages cannot ascertain the plan of the Lord. The best policy is simply to abide by the orders of the Lord without argument. The sufferings of the Pandavas were never due to their past deeds. The Lord had to execute the plan of establishing the kingdom of virtue, and therefore his own devotees suffered temporarily in order to establish the conquest of virtue. Bhishma Dev was certainly satisfied by seeing the triumph of virtue, and he was glad to see King Yudhisthira on the throne, although himself he fought against him. Even a great fighter like Bhishma could not win the battle of Kurukshetra because the Lord wanted to show that vice cannot conquer virtue, regardless of who tries to execute it. Bhishma Dev was a great devotee of the Lord, but he chose to fight against the Pandavas by the will of the Lord because the Lord wanted to show that a fighter like Bhishma cannot win on the wrong side. Today, we are reading from Canto 1 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 9, entitled The Passing Away of Bhishma Dev, Text 16. The Battle of Kurukshetra had recently concluded, and the Pandavas were victorious. After being coronated as the king of the world, Yudhisthira Maharaj, rather than celebrating his victory, rather than feeling great joy that after being persecuted for so many years. He had finally gained the throne that he was entitled to. He felt miserable because he was blaming himself for all of the sorrow, for all of the death and the tears that was caused by this great battle. He was thinking, just for me to ascend to this throne, look at all the widows who are crying for their husbands. Look at all the children who are crying for their fathers. Look at all the parents, brokenhearted, weeping for their sons. And look at all these people who have lost their lives. He was faultless, but yet he was seeing only faults in himself. And because this was a symptom of his humility, of his devotion, Krishna himself personally wanted to alleviate the sufferings. Within this world, the nature of the false ego is we want to blame people for our own faults, our own shortcomings. The tendency is to compensate that it's because of other people or other things or other situations. We want to blame people for our shortcomings, and we want to take the credit for what other people do. That is a tendency. Srila Prabhupada, what he did, unbelievable. He went on that Jaladuta, August the 13th, was a Friday, sailed something like 38 days on a cargo ship. All of the physical ailments he had on the way. He came to New York City just having two heart attacks, seasickness, 70 years old, no money, nothing. That's how he began his mission. Nobody was there to help him. Nobody in India wanted to help him. They all said it was hopeless. Was fruitless, come back, be like the rest of us, do what you can here. And by his austerities, by his determination, by his unlimited love and compassion for all beings, by his total devotion to the order of his Gurudev, he spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. And here was London. Quite incredible, because London ruled over India for years. And here, Srila Prabhupada, there were hundreds and hundreds of devotees from all over the world gathered at Bhaktivedanta Manor in London. He was installing the deities of Radha Gokulananda. What a great landmark of incredible success. And the next day was his Vyas Puja. And Srila Prabhupada read from Sri Chaitanya. He quoted a verse from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. And then he told how it had just been published. And he said, all due to the hard work of His Grace Prajumana Prabhu, who I call Mahashoy. It is not my work. It is because of his hard work. The credit goes to him and his wife, Arundhati, who edited. And then he started talking about so many of his other devotees. Most of them were actually grihasthas he was talking about. Men and women, husbands and wives, how they have successfully opened so many centers and established, you know, the BBT and done so much work to publish his books. He was giving all credit to everyone else. This is the mood of a Vaishnava. One who is starving within needs to get all sorts of adoration, prestige, and credit. But one who actually has, is tasting Krishna within, doesn't need that. Such a person feels infinitely greater pleasure giving credit to others. The amount of joy that we get taking credit for ourselves is like, it's like a drop of salt water when you're thirsty. It just makes you more thirsty. The more credit you get, the more you need. The more prestige you get, the more you need. It's like that. You're thirsty and you get a drop of salt water. Kind of tastes, it tastes really good, but it makes you more thirsty. But from the Vaishnava perspective, when we actually learn the art, it actually, for the heart, for the ego, you know, this gives a little bit of satisfaction. It's really that satisfaction just agitates you for more. But for the heart, there is unlimitedly more satisfaction in giving credit to others, in seeing the good qualities in others. That's how a Vaishnav lives. That's how our acharyas have taught us. And here we're speaking about Yudhisthira. He was absolutely faultless. And yet, rather than blaming Duryodhana, he's blaming himself. Vaishnavera kriya mudra vikena bujaya. It's very difficult to understand the mind of a Vaishnav. It seems logically inconsistent. But that was his mood. He saw so much suffering and he took responsibility. So Krishna is bringing Yudhisthira Maharaj all the way back from Hastinapur to Kurukshetra. That place is still there, Bhishma Kund in Kurukshetra, where Bhishma was laying in a bed of arrows. He was quite an inconceivable person too. Vaishnava is very difficult. Mahabharata, you really have to go deep into the purports of the acharyas to understand what's really happening. Otherwise, it's just an amazing story. But we're not just so concerned with the amazing story. We're concerned with the inner meaning of what Krishna is teaching us. And actually, just by reading Mahabharata, we cannot understand it. We must understand it from the enlightened, realized souls. And therefore, very, very important, crucial aspects of Mahabharata are retold in the Srimad Bhagavatam.
And they're spoken by Shukadev Goswami. He's really taking the essence of the Mahabharata when he speaks these stories. And then we have all the great acharyas giving their commentaries. Sanatan Goswami, Ramanuja Acharya, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Sridhar Swami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Srila Prabhupada has taken all of these commentaries and taken the essence of all of them and with his own personal divine realizations and given us the Bhaktivedanta purports. Bhishma, he chose to fight on the side of Duryodhana. Unbelievable. Duryodhana was envious, wicked, cruel, murderous. He was an excellent manager. He was a super excellent organizer, manager. He was good at PR. Materially, Duryodhana was top class. I mean, you know, he could make the CEOs of the greatest corporations anywhere in the world look like fools. He was good. He would bring you to the top no matter what, somehow or other. He knew how to do it. He could take over the entire world. That was how expert he was. He was tremendous at diplomacy also. When it came time, you know, he took over the kingdom along with Dhritarashtra, his father. But not only that, but when it came time for the Kurukshetra battle, they were canvassing allies. It's kind of like what happens in the parliament here in India. What do they call it? I don't know politics, I'm sorry. I don't know the words you use or anything like that. But one party needs other parties to join them in order to get the majority, yes? Huh? Anyways, it takes a lot of diplomacy to do that. Well, Duryodhana, Yudhisthira was canvassing people to join his army. And Duryodhana, it's not just a bunch of demons. There were some really good people. That Duryodhana, his diplomacy, he was very, very gracious and very hospitable and very very well-mannered and kind to people in order to get them on his side. And he won over almost double the amount as the Pandavas. Even Bhishma. Bhishma knew he was wicked and he was cruel. He did all this nice diplomacy and acted very polite and everything else, but he had ulterior motives. He wanted to rule, that's all. Hook or crook, he would do it. Any means. Bhishma saw it all. He suffered miserably. He suffered giving up. He was supposed to be the king himself. But just to please his father, he gave up his rights so his father could get married to the woman he wanted. Quite a sacrifice. And then he had to see
so many atrocities. The next king that came was killed. And then Pandu died in the forest for some inconceivable reason. And then Yudhisthira, who was just from his very birth, he was the most pious, most loving, most qualified person in the entire world. And he was being subdued. When he grew a little older into a child with his four brothers, they were persecuted. There was a plot to burn them alive in that house of lack. Even Kunti Devi, the idea was Kunti and her all of her children were going to be burned alive while they're sleeping. That was Duryodhana's way of thinking. Bhishma saw it all. He knew what was happening. He saw how that gambling match was cheating, total cheating. There was nothing fair about it. 100% the Pandavas could only lose. And then they were banished to the forest. Bhishma watched as Draupadi was about to be stripped naked just before Krishna came to rescue her. He saw so much. He was always on the Pandava side. Why, when it came to the war, he chose to fight for Duryodhana? Some people say it's because Duryodhana maintained him financially, and because he was the king, he had to be loyal. Externally, that is there. But here, Srila Prabhupada is revealing us internally. Bhishma understood the plan of the Lord. He knew he would lose and he would die. Just to show the world, even the most powerful, the most expert of everybody is going to lose if they're on the wrong side. And he was so great, he massacred in one day a major portion of the Pandava army. Consider this. This is the reality. Bhishma single-handedly had the ability to destroy the entire Pandava army. Of all the millions of soldiers, actually, they didn't even need them. Bhishma alone could massacre everybody. He was good. That's why Duryodhana was so confident. He has to win. There's no question of losing with Bhishma. And Duryodhana got Bhishma angry and he went into the battlefield next day and it was a massacre. And the Pandavas were totally depressed. We can't even stand before him. How can you fight against a man like that? It's like a hurricane, a cyclone. Yes, have you ever seen a hurricane or a cyclone when it comes just and you're shooting arrows at it? What do you do? That's the that day. The Pandavas were just watching, you know, like what? Bhishma was too much. And Krishna told the Pandavas, you have to just go and ask Bhishma how he could be killed. That's the only way. Because he can't be killed any other way. He has a benediction. Nobody could kill him. But if you ask him, he'll tell you the secret. And they went to talk to Bhishma, and Bhishma was happy. He said, yes, I've been waiting for this day to tell someone how to kill me. I want to die.
I'm sick of this material world with all the atrocities and all the diplomacy and all the envy and all the anger and all the lust and all the arrogance. This material world is just, I want to go back to my home. He was a Vasu. He was living in the planets of the Rishis. Not just the heavens. These are above the heavens, the planets of the Rishis and the sages. Swargalokas, the heavenly planets, where Indra's enjoying like anything. But then Maharloka, Tapaloka, these planets are planets of great Rishis. They're enjoying millions of times more than the heavens, sitting in meditation. That's what they do. So he wanted to get out of this material world. He considered it like a curse that he wouldn't die and that nobody could defeat him. He wanted to be defeated. So he could get out of this place. So he told the Pandavas, with great joy, this is how you could kill me. Just bring Sikandi in front of me and let her shoot the first arrow. And then Arjuna, shoot with all your might and cover me from my neck to my toes with arrows. They have to go all the way through my body, from the front through the back. There shouldn't be space to even put a single finger between the arrows. How many of you would give such an instruction to someone? It's quite serious. It's painful. And Arjuna, on the battlefield, Arjuna was shooting, but he loved Bhishma, so he was shooting with love. He was going... And what didn't work? It wasn't penetrating. Bhishma's body was like a mountain. He said, he was chastising Arjuna, harder, harder, with all your might. And Arjuna was weeping and crying with tears of love going, they were going right through. Nobody else had the power to penetrate his body. It was so strong. And after all these arrows from his neck to his toes, hundreds and hundreds of arrows piercing all the way through his body, through every one of his organs, right? They were... So many arrows going through his kidneys and his liver and his heart and his lungs and his gallbladder. Every part of his body was totally pierced, right? His thyroid. And he didn't die. He just laid down. And he stayed alive. Who would want to stay alive with all those arrows in you? And everybody came and offered their pranams to him. They stopped the battle for the day. And they continued the next day, and so many days, and he was just laying there watching. And they left the battlefield. They went back to Hastinapur, coronation. And Krishna knew that Bhishma was waiting only for him. He would not die without seeing Krishna, without offering his love to Krishna. And Krishna came for his devotee, that person who fought against his devotee was his devotee. Because Krishna knew that Bhishma was willing to be an instrument of fighting on the wrong side and being misunderstood for all time to come. Just for Krishna to teach the world a lesson. That however great you are, however skilled you are, however powerful you are, if you're not doing it for Krishna, if you're not doing it with Dharma, then eventually you will lose. You can appear to be winning for some time, like Duryodhana, but it's just a matter of time. So Yudhisthira was in this state where he was giving whatever greatness and whatever achievements he had accomplished, he gave all credits to Krishna and to all other people. And he was taking the responsibility for faults that were not his own. So Krishna brought him before Bhishma. And Bhishma instructs him. And when Bhishma sees the Pandavas, the first thing he's thinking is why? Why such good people have to suffer so bad in this material world? It wasn't because of karma. Because they were so pure. The nature of the material world is simply people have to suffer. When Nimai Pandit and all the devotees were Srivas Thakur, when they were performing Nam Sankirtan in Srivasangam, the house of Srivas, one of the common criticisms of the atheistic people is whether you're a sinful materialist breaking all the laws of religion, or whether you're a pure saint performing great tapasya. Still, you have to grow old and disease and die. So what is the difference? That's what they were saying. It's there in Sri Chaitanya Bhagavat. Why should we give up our drinking and going to find, you know, nice, beautiful women and somehow or other accumulating wealth and power and prestige? Why should we give these things up? It feels good. These people are giving all these things up and they're living such pious lives, but they get sick just like us. They get old just like us. And they die just like us. We don't see a difference. What's the use? This way they would blaspheme the devotees. You people are just a bunch of idiots. You're fools. You're crazy. You're wasting your lives. And you're inducing other people to do the same thing. Don't go near my children and influence them with this stuff. We need our children to accumulate more money and carry on what we're doing and to help us and to enjoy life to the fullest capacity. And your influence, you're making them brahmacharis? Giving up all these things? For what? For what? Brahmachari ashram, people are sick all the time. go to Bhaktivedanta Hospital, you'll always see some brahmachari laying in the bed, you know? What to speak of these grihastas? They're living with such high principles, for what? The people at Srivasangam wasn't using these specific examples, but this was their spirit. We hear this all the time. This is a universal criticism of people who are not religious. And to today's world, in the name of science, in the name of the advancement of civilization, people are giving so much evidence through the lens of their own egos, to prove that there is no God. And therefore, these religious people are simply superstitious, sentimental, weak-minded people. And they're misleading the society to not enjoy the real pleasures of life. But when Krishna comes, when Ram comes, they don't tell us that if you become a devotee, material life, you will not suffer. On the material level, everyone has to suffer. Everyone has to grow old. Everyone has to get diseased. Everyone has to die. And everyone has tribulations. The Pandavas were pious. They had no record of bad karma. But yet they suffered like this. And look at poor little Kunti. She was such a pious lady. And not only that, she was totally surrendered to Krishna at every moment. But what she had to endure, she had to see her children being banished. Could you imagine how she worried about them? And she was right there in the palace, hearing the rumors that were against her children. And she saw her eldest son fighting against her other children in a battle. And then one of her sons was killed by his younger brother. Can you imagine Kunti's heart? A mother's heart? And she was a great devotee. Not only was she a great devotee, she was Krishna's auntie. She loved Krishna not only as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but as her nephew. What a great soul. Why did she have to suffer like this? In the material world, it's the way material nature works. We can judge things by karma, good karma, bad karma. Those in karma kanda, they understand that good karma brings good results, bad karma brings bad results. But even in karma kanda, if you actually go deep into it, it's not just about having a pleasurable life in this world. Because even the best karmakandis who give so much charity and do so much philanthropy and who do so much selfless service to humanity, they suffer like everyone else. They may get some good benefits for a while, but still, we see it happens. Actually, if you go deep into the philosophy of karmakanda, they're doing it so that in their next life they could go to the heavenly planets where there's a much greater degree of happiness. But this little earth planet, Dukalaya Mashashvatam, there's happiness, there's distress. Padam padam yadvi padam natesham. There's danger at every step, whoever you are. This beautiful verse, padam padam yadvi padam natesham, it describes that those who go back to Godhead, they're happy. They're no longer in this world where there is danger at every step. But whoever you are, even if you're a paramhamsa, great devotee, still there's danger at every step in this world. For what reason? Achintya, inconceivable. Why Prabhupada had to get these heart attacks? And then he gets to New York
And he starts the movement with a few people, and he has a stroke. Inconceivable. Why Srivas Thakur's son died? He's just a little boy. This is all very inconceivable. Bhishma, he's Mahajan. And of these 12 great authorities, Srila Prabhupada in purport, he said, even Shiva and Brahma, even Yamaraj can't understand. Even Shukadev Goswami and Kapila Dev cannot understand. Even Swayambhuva Manu, the greatest authorities who we have to follow their footsteps for realization, they cannot understand the inconceivable will of the Lord. Why things happen in this material world, even to great people, how they happen. We can have arguments about it. We could think about it. We could question. We could study every scripture trying to find answers. And Bhishma saying, you'll never find the answer. You could think you do. Everybody thinks they do. It's because of this. It's because of this. So much. Everyone likes to think they know. But what makes a Mahajan? A Mahajan is someone who knows that they don't know. Yes? That's the difference. We argue about so many things with each other and we become enemies. But the Mahajans understand the Lord's will is inconceivable. But there's one thing that is absolutely 100% certain at all times. Kaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashati. Krishna always protects his devotees. Yes, devotees' bodies get old, get sick. Sometimes they get in accidents. Sometimes they're wounded. Sometimes they die. Sometimes they fail. But devotees understand the eternal nature of the soul. Jivara Swarupur Krishnara Ditya Das. That we're eternal servants of Krishna. We're eternal parts and parcels of Krishna. This is the basis of the Gita. The soul cannot be cut into pieces by weapons, cannot be burned by fire, cannot be. Nothing of material energy can touch the eternal soul. Because the soul is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. The Atma is part and parcel of Krishna. The Atma has the natural capacity for ecstatic love. Love for Krishna. Awareness of the brotherhood and sisterhood of every living being. That is our capacity. The capacity of the soul is to see the Atma in a lizard and see the sacredness of a part of Krishna. That is who we are. The body's going to go through all these changes. So Krishna consciousness is about realizing our eternal servitude toward Krishna and understanding that in this world there is danger at every step. In this world, everything is temporary. In this world, however pious and good and philanthropic and altruistic and nationalistic and generous and kind and loving, still you can suffer at any moment. That's the way the world is. maybe less. But we see some of the cruelest, most selfish, envious people enjoying the most in this world. Yes? Their karma will get them eventually. They will have to suffer every act they do. And in one sense, we can trace out that if I'm suffering, it must be due to some karma I did in a past life, even if I'm good in this life. That's all right. But you have to suffer anyway. No matter what you do and not do, you still have to suffer. Maybe less, maybe more. But Krishna says, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka. That means even the most pious people in the higher planets have to suffer. This material existence is a place of misery. Krishna conscious is about realizing who we really are and living according to that principle. Even if we haven't attained that state, we're living according to that principle. I'm living in harmony with the will of my soul for Krishna. And even if suffering comes, still, I'm going to live according to that principle. Because the nature of the soul is to please Krishna. So this is for certain, that Krishna is always there to reciprocate with the love of his devotee. Always. 100% truth. Krishna says, it is my promise. I will be there for my devotees. In this recent tragedy, where we lost 8 of our devotees, we may never be able to understand why it happened like that. Why at their ages? They were all young. Some very young. They were so pure. They were so loving. They were so devotional. On Sunday we will speak more elaborately on the subject. Why? We may not understand. It's achintya. It's inconceivable the way the material world works. But one thing we know 100% for sure. Because these devotees did have such open, loving hearts and devotion to Krishna, and so eager to serve the Vaishnavas, that absolutely Krishna was there to embrace them. Embrace their immortal souls and lift them up. Lift them up on the path back home, back to Godhead. For sure, 100%. So in this sense, in the sorrow of separation, there's joy. And it's better to focus on what is for certain than focus on all our speculations. For certain, they're with Krishna. Absolutely. The all-attractive, all-beautiful, all-loving, supreme personality of God, their atmas are reunited with Krishna. For certain. Why things happen, when things happen, in this material world, very difficult to understand. We could learn lessons. We could learn lessons and make policies of where devotees shouldn't go. Because we want devotees to stay. It's such a tragedy when devotees are taken away from us. It's a tragedy for the world. And it's every one of our duties to protect the sacredness of the bodies of the devotees. But when something inconceivable happens on the earthly level, we learn lessons. We may not understand the intimate reasons why, how, when, where. But we know for sure. Even if a devotee makes a mistake, Krishna will be there. Because Krishna doesn't see our earthly mistakes. Krishna sees our heart of love and devotion. And he's going to be there for that. The earthly mistakes affect the earthly body. But the sincerity of our devotion is what Krishna is what attracts the all-attractive Krishna to give shelter to our soul. This is truth. Recently, a very learned sannyasi of a different line, a different sampradaya, he was asking me questions about Lord Chaitanya for about an hour and a half. It was a very deep subject, very incredible conversation. And he asked me the first question. He said, I have studied the six systems of philosophy from the Vedic literatures. I know Sanskrit. He's very learned. He said, I know what beta and beta means. Oneness and difference. He said, but I want to know from you, what is Lord Chaitanya's conception of achintya? He said, I know this achintya beta beta tattva is the foundation of his teaching. Beta beta tattva, I understand, I've studied. But why achintya? Achintya means inconceivable. Advaita. Advaita means everything's one. Ultimately, the absolute truth is one, and there is nothing separate from that oneness. Advaita means ultimately beyond the world of Maya, where there is forms and personalities, and there is all sorts of dualities and differentiations, is Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. I am that Brahman. And in that Brahman there is the all-pervading oneness where duality does not exist. That's conception of Advaita. That God is one and nothing is separate from that one. Everything is ultimately just one. But then the Vaishnavacharyas, Ramanujacharya, he taught Vashishtadvaita. Everybody agrees with the one. Everyone agrees that everything ultimately is one. But qualified monism. That yes, the absolute truth is one. And nothing could be different from that one. Nothing could be outside of that one. But within that one, there is infinite variegatedness. There is infinite personalities. There is infinite pastimes. So they're not saying it's not one. They're just explaining what's happening within that one. Manvishnu Sami Shuddhadvaita. Sripad Balabhacharya. He was in that line. And he focused only on Vrindavan Leela. Yes, everything is one. Shuddhadvaita, pure oneness. Pure oneness is what the gopis love for Krishna. within that Advaita, the pure understanding is the incredible, intimate, loving relationships. And there's Dvaita-Dvaita. Advaita, Madhvacharya. He said,
that in every way there is differentiation. Within that oneness, everything is different. Quite powerful presentation. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to synthesize all these different systems. Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, Vishnu Swami, Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, and Lakshmi Devi. He came to synthesize all these philosophies, take the essence of all of them, and create Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. Inconceivably simultaneously one and different. So this one and difference, he understood, but why Achintya? What does that mean? So he explained, everything that exists is Achintya. The absolute truth is inconceivable. We cannot fathom with our intelligence. We cannot fathom with our, by any means. Even the best computers could never work out the conclusion. What to speak of this little human brain? Everything we see is in Chintya. This little plastic box. If we actually study this plastic box, this plastic box is inconceivable. Yes? The sun. In order for this plastic box to exist, begins with the sun. The sun is inconceivable. How many of you have started a fire? Please raise your hand. How many of you in your life have started a fire? God, people in Bombay really are dependent on all this artificial technology. Anyways, if you start a fire, you have to keep putting fuel in the fire, otherwise the fire goes out. Yes? Put some wood, and then it gets big, and then the fuel is consumed. You keep more and more and more wood, more and more coal, more and more oil, whatever you're using. Well, look at the sun. How much fire is coming out of the sun? And it's not like, you know, if the demigods are all putting coal into it. Going to coal mines in Indraloka and having these flower airplanes delivering big flower airplanes of gas that say flammable liquids don't. It's incredible. For billions of years, the sun is just unlimitedly, from our perspective, it's unlimited fire. And it's the same size. Yes? It's not that it's like, it's the same size. How is that possible? Where is the fuel coming from? Scientists can speculate for the rest of their for the rest of Kali Yuga. But really, how is it happening? They're saying some gas and this and that, but where it's burning unlimited gas, and where's the gas coming from? Why it's not getting smaller? Who's feeding it? It's fire. It's unbelievable. Same size. It's the same size as it was 10 billion years ago. Huh? Is that inconceivable? And it rises and sets same time. We could calculate. And we're orbiting. And then that sun, that sun shines on a little seed. This big. Tiny little seed. And that little seed becomes a tree. Now, isn't that inconceivable?
how a tree comes out of a little seed? Isn't it inconceivable how every human being came out of a little seed? In Bombay, there's so much inconceivable. 15 million inconceivable people here. Yes? We just look at people. You know, when you're on the train and you're crowded and you're crushed and you're being smashed and it's 100 degrees out and 40 degrees Celsius and it's hot and you're thinking all these people, it's too crowded. That's one way to look at it. Another is, look at all these, every one of these people is an incredible miracle. They were just, this person who's crushing me used to be a little seed in the mother. And out of that little seed, and you know, I don't want to get into details, but you know, the semen of a man is not any, it's pretty grotesque actually. It's just some slimy little thing goes into the mother, and there's a little seed in it. Unbelievable. And then it starts growing, and a heart. You know what, the man's semen? It's just a messy little thing. And from that little seed, a heart forms, and lungs, and kidneys, and eyes, and ears, and nose, and mouth, and tongue, and toes, and fingers. Unbelievable. And it comes out as a baby. The baby's totally bewildered. And then that baby has the capacity to learn how to talk and learn how to walk and learn how to run and learn how to build buildings and learn how to crush us in the train. And learn how to get angry and swear and everything like that at somebody else. We could just be annoyed by it, but we could think, what a miracle. What an inconceivable miracle. And when a mosquito comes and bites us, what an inconceivable, it's inconceivable. How that insect knows how to suck our blood. How that insect knows how to fly. How that insect was born. Everything is inconceivable. It's beyond human imagination. You know, because we see it all the time, we give our technical explanations of how it's happening, but actually it's really inconceivable. So the tree is growing, and the sun is shining on the tree, and the sun is putting fire into the wood. The element of fire through photosynthesis and whatever the scientific explanations is going into the tree and it's growing. And what is the wood when you go to burn it? It's because the energy that the sun has put into the wood. And when trees fall down and go underground after millions of years, they become coal, and the same energy of the fire is still there. And when the coal, after millions of years or whatever, it becomes oil. Yes? And that oil still has what the sun, millions of years ago, has put into it. That energy of fire. And then we take that oil and we make plastic. Yes? It's inconceivable. Unbelievable. This box, we could go till the end, till Kalki Avatar comes, we could be trying to understand the inconceivable nature of this plastic box. Everything's inconceivable. Because Krishna's achintya, everything that is emanating from Krishna is achintya. Om Purnamada Purnamidam. If we really try to understand it deeply. And that's just this material existence. What to speak of aparayami tashtvanyam prakritim virime param. The jiva is beyond material existence. The jiva is transcendental.
The jiva is part of Krishna. The jiva is Krishna's marginal energy, purely spiritual, but has inconceivable free will to either enter into material existence or enter into spiritual existence. And when the jiva decides to enter into material existence, dukalayam ashashvatam, no matter who we are or what we are, there's suffering. There's danger. But when the spirit soul, the jiva, even within material existence, takes shelter of the Supreme Lord, then the atma, it's the body is used for the purpose of its spiritual devotional service. But the atma then comes under the control of the spiritual energy. The atma becomes liberated. And the body's an instrument, may still have to go through the nature of material existence, prakriti, but the atma is beyond. And Krishna says, sarva dharman parityasya. Just surrender to me. I will deliver you from this. That's delivering the atma. And he can deliver the atma even while we're living in this body. And he can deliver the atma when we leave this body. And in the spiritual world, everything inconceivable. We read in scriptures how when Krishna comes, he lifts Govardhan Hill with the little finger of left hand. He shows his mother the entire universe within his mouth. He has an incredible population of people living on that little island of Dwarka without traffic jams. It's not that the people of Dwarka are saying, you know, let's go to Krishna's palace, but we should leave by 6 in the morning so we don't get caught in traffic. Because there's so many quadrillions of people living in Dwarka. It's not like that. They all have big yards and lawns and everybody's living happily. How is it possible? Everything that exists is in chintya. So when Krishna comes to this world and wants to perform his pastimes, he makes it very extraordinarily a chintya. Very visibly inconceivable. And for us to believe it, of course, Krishna could do whatever he likes. Just like that cobbler. He was told by Narada Muni that Krishna was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. And the cobbler said, oh, how wonderful. And Narada Muni said, do you believe that? He said, of course. Krishna can do anything. He can put a banyan tree in a seed. He could put an elephant through the eye of a needle. He could put 100 million people in this temple room. And everybody could be dancing without bumping into each other. Yes? So, now you may think the Swami is just saying all kinds of stuff. But actually, Krishna could do anything. He could keep the temple room the same size. He could bring 10 million people in the temple. And he could double our size. And still we could have a beautiful kirtan. Achintya, inconceivable. Time and space and geographical, all this stuff, is Krishna's beyond it all. So how we are one and how we are different from Krishna is an inconceivable situation. How Brahman can be playing with Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi, we are Brahman, and Krishna's Brahman, and there's no difference between us and Krishna. We're absolutely the same, and a sun ray is absolutely the same as the sun. But how can there be, in that absolute oneness, There is eternal differentiation simply to facilitate love, ecstatic love. Ultimately, Krishna is just loving himself. Sri Radharani is Krishna. There's no difference. Radha is Krishna, Krishna is Radha, depending on whose side you're on. Some say that Krishna is an expansion of Radha, and others say that Radha is an expansion of Krishna. It's inconceivable. They're both right. That's pretty inconceivable. My name, Radhanath. Some Brijabasis say Radhanath means the Lord of Radha. And other Brijabasis say that means Radha is the Lord of Krishna. Who's right? Radhanath. Just like Jagannath means... So different, and that's inconceivable. Some are seeing Krishna as a friend, some are seeing Krishna as a lover, some are seeing Krishna as a son, some are seeing Krishna as a master. Inconceivable. So when we see the events that happen in this material world, we should understand that even great Bhishma, Brahma, Shiva, they cannot understand how things happen in this world, especially in the lives of devotees. But one thing we know for sure, Krishna is always there. For those who love the devotees, Krishna is always there to love them. And we can speculate, where does a person go when they die? Maybe they went here, maybe they're taking births in a pious family of devotees, maybe they're in Vaikuntha, maybe they're in Goloka, maybe they're in a heavenly planet, you know, doing pujas. We know for sure that for a person who even once sincerely chants Krishna's name, Krishna's going to be there for them. What to speak of devotees who have given their hearts and their lives to serve the Lord, to serve the Vaishnavas, to help Srila Prabhupada's mission. We can know that Krishna is going to fully be there. Because Krishna's the supreme lover. And his love is inconceivable. And it never fails. He's within our hearts. And Krishna is going to do whatever is ultimately absolutely the best in his love for his devotees. When they depart from this world. That we know for sure. So let us always, in the tears of separation from our beloved devotees, it is absolutely proper to feel pain and to cry in separation for Vaishnavas. We can cultivate that, but it should not be tears of emptiness. The tears should be offerings of our love, of our gratitude for their eternal souls, knowing that Krishna, that they are with Krishna. Thank you very much.
Is there any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, you are saying that this material world is a suffering. Anybody who comes into taken birth in this material world has to suffer. Either he is a devotee or is not a devotee. Birth, death, old age, disease is going to come. Well, Pandavas have also suffered, and we know he has suffered, they have suffered very much. But a stage came in Pandavas also where Yudhishthira Maharaj was also bewildered. He told to Krishna that, Krishna, why these things are happening to us? We are all your devotees. So sometimes that fear comes in our heart also, that when Pandavas were also getting bewildered, we could also get bewildered in our process of devotional life. And at that time, because we were bewildered, our emotionally we are very weak because of problems. Spiritually also we are very weak. And because of that, our sadhana, our association, and everything is loose at that time. At that time, to get that hard dose of Krishna consciousness to make us completely focused and fixed up is very difficult at that tragic time. So what do the devotee has to do during that tragic time where the bewilderment is there? To come back on the track and remain focused into Krishna consciousness.
Satsang. Association of devotees, association of sincere devotees, mahatsevam dwaram ahurva muktvais. We need to hear from great souls, we need to serve great souls. In that association, we gain determination. But then we must use that determination. Because we always have free will. We have the choice to associate with people who will inspire us. But then once we're inspired, we still have the choice whether we're going to utilize that inspiration. So we have to be sincere. Krishna sees our sincerity. What is our motive and what is the efforts we're making to express that motive in our life? We understand things philosophically, but Maya is very strong. And Maya is always there, 24 hours a day, forever. She's going to be there to somehow or other try to distract us from the path of pure bhakti. And she has unlimited methods of distraction. But we have to be very sincere. And that sincerity comes through determination. To follow the principles, to chant the holy names, to live with good character. And we need the association of devotees to keep us focused. Does that answer your question? And then we must use our free will to do what is favorable for devotional service.
Maharaj, the second point which I could not understand is about Bhishma Dev. When he is considered as a Mahajan and he has struggled so much, and also that too also when he was leaving his body, at that time Krishna was also in front of him. Then why is it so that he didn't go back home, back to God, and he went into Brahma Loka or in some higher planetary system?
That was just a stop. That was just a stop over to do some seva. He's a pure devotee. He's going back to Godhead. He's already back to Godhead internally. But he had some seva to do by joining his brothers, the Vasus, in one of the upper planets. That's where he was meant to go.
So he went there to do seva. Similarly, Nala Kuvera Manigriva, they surrendered to Krishna and they went back to their heavenly abode. But they went back as pure devotees. So they will certainly go back to Godhead. Just like pure devotees may have some seva in this world, sometimes pure devotees may go to upper planets to do some seva. But internally they have gone back home, back to Godhead. Is there any other questions? Radhe Shyam Prabhu. After yesterday, it's Achintya that you're asking another question.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much, Maharaj, for such a wonderful, enlivening and enlightening class. I liked especially the explanation you gave for the varieties of examples you gave on Achintya. That was a very wonderful example of the sun and the person in the train who's crushing and all that. Thank you very much, Maharaj. Maharaj, I had a question on one of your first points in the class today on taking credit. I heard that Gopal Bhatta Goswami and some Vaishnavas mentioned, they said that we will tell you about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, but provided you don't mention our name in the scripture, like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, you know, they wanted their names to be avoided. So oftentimes I used to feel that the Vaishnava community becomes deprived of some valuable information about those Vaishnavas who wanted their names to be avoided. At the same time, I had a question also that in India, traditionally, whether it is Tulasidas or Kabirdas, you know, in their poetry, they write their chap, they put their name as Tulasi or Kabir. Similarly, Narottama Das, Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, they put their names. Is it to keep the authenticity of the poem and they put the name? How can it be understood that they don't desire any credit? So it will be clear, it will be nice, Maharaj, these two questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your wonderful question. According to our service to Krishna, these great souls, sometimes not for themselves, but for the sake of the people in general, becoming famous is a way to reach people's hearts. Yes? You know, Srila Prabhupada, on every temple, founder Acharya, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Prabhupada was not taking any credit for anything, but but the fame that he gained was a austerity to be performed. A humble person to get fame is a tremendous austerity. But it's a way in which we could reach, great souls could reach people's hearts. Yes? Because people listen to those who, you know, who are notable. So sometimes devotees do for that reason. They're willing to perform the severe austerity of accepting recognition, never keeping it for themselves, but just using it for the service of others. And other devotees will not accept it. You know, many devotees didn't say that to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. You know, Rupa Goswami didn't say, "Don't say my name." Sanatan Goswami did not say that. Therefore, there's chapters and chapters and chapters about them. But Gopal Bhatta Goswami did.
So Lord Chaitanya wanted to show through different devotees the same principle. They all have the same consciousness. They all don't want fame, prestige, or recognition. One is showing such an incredible sacrifice not to be spoken of in the greatest book in history. Yes? And others, for the sake of glorifying Lord Chaitanya, let my name be. Yes? For they are both expressing the same principle in different ways, how we could best serve. And they each of them served in a perfect way for society, to give up particular examples. And your second question was?
In all the writings and songs.
Oh, yes, yes, okay. We could see it that when Bhaktivinoda or Narottam Das Thakur or other such acharyas are giving their names, even Srila Prabhupada, after every chapter, he says, thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports. It's an expression of total surrender, humble surrender to the Lord. It's very personal, because Vaishnavism is thoroughly personal. So as eternal, loving, humble servants of the Lord, they are personally offering these prayers. They are personally offering these purports. Not to get credit or prestige, but for the purpose of making a personal offering to the Lord, a personal offering to the Parampara. Srila Prabhupada, in his prayer, he says, Krishna, you have given me this name, Bhaktivedanta, even though I have no devotion and no knowledge. Now it is up to you to fulfill the purport of Bhaktivedanta. So that's Prabhupada's heart. That's how he's feeling. So when he says, thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports, we can understand through his prayer, that's how he's feeling when he says Bhaktivedanta. So deep, so pure, such love, such humility. And generally when Bhaktivinoda or Narottam's name is there, it's usually always in the most humble state of praying and crying for mercy. Yes, as Prabhupada's prayers. So it's personal. And that makes it even sweeter. Does that answer your question?
Maharaj, in the introduction to Lilamrita, Dr. Harvey Cox, he says the parampara is not a lineage of faceless masters, but every master repeating the message, but in an original way. He says, so when I read that sentence, I also felt that all the parampara acharyas, they have their individuality and originality. Along with that, without adulterating the message or diluting the message, they present it purely. So like there is a purport by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati on Srimad Bhagavatam. Similarly, Prabhupada's purport is unique without diluting the message. So that is how I also understood the Bhaktivedanta purports. And the explanation that you gave is even more sweeter, because it is a personal offering of Srila Prabhupada to Krishna. Thank you very much, Maharaj.
Thank you. Allow me to give you this Kadamba card.
the fragrance of this garland is achintya. It's inconceivable. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.